Southwest Universe Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump says he's made a decision on the international Iranian nuclear agreement, but declined to say what it was. Mr. Trump has been highly critical of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, since it was signed by the previous Obama administration, Iran, and five countries in 2015. Late Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met in New York with the other signatories to the deal.
We clearly have significant issues with the agreement. The president's been quite clear and articulate as to his concerns about the agreement itself.
Mr. Trump is obligated to inform Congress whether Iran is in compliance with the agreement that temporarily curbs its nuclear activity every 90 days. The next deadline is October 15th. Speaking Wednesday to the U.N. General Assembly, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said his country would not be the first to violate the deal, but would respond decisively and resolutely to its violation by any party. General John Hyten, the head of U.S. Strategic Command, said Wednesday Iran is operating under the agreement, while also rapidly deploying and developing a series of ballistic missiles. Kenya's Supreme Court has criticized the country's election commission for failing to verify official results of last month's presidential election before declaring President Uhuru Kenyatta the winner. David Maraga is the court's chief justice.
A declaration is hereby issued that the presidential election held on the 8th August 2017 was not conducted in accordance with the Constitution and the applicable law, rendering the declared results invalid, null and void.
The court nullified the August 8 election, but it did not find anyone on the commission guilty of wrongdoing. The court has ordered a new election October 17th. This is VOA News. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met with President Donald Trump Wednesday on the sidelines of the UN meeting. Through an interpreter, he expressed confidence in a breakthrough in peace efforts with Israel.
And we are very certain that you, Mr. President, are determined to reach real peace in the Middle East. And this gives us the assurance and the confidence that we are on the verge of real peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Mr. Abbas said their meeting represents the seriousness of Mr. Trump to achieve the deal of the century in the Middle East in coming months. The president sounded equally upbeat.
I think we have a very, very good chance, and I certainly will devote everything within my heart and within my soul to get that deal made.
But during his General Assembly remarks, Mr. Abbas denounced the apartheid regime imposed on Palestinians by Israel and warned against abandoning the two-state solution. U.S.-backed Syrian rebels Wednesday said the campaign to liberate the northern Syrian city of Raqqa from Islamic State is in its final stages. The Syrian Democratic Forces said they've taken back 80% of the city, which has been under attack since June. The UN Wednesday launched an effort to bring stability to Libya to end 6 years of turmoil following the collapse of the regime of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was at the meeting.
It is my deep belief that there is an opportunity for a political solution in Libya.
Mr. Guterres was joined by new UN envoy Ghassan Salameh, along with the French, British, and Egyptian heads of state, as well as the head of the UN-backed Libyan administration, Fayez al-Sarraj. The initiative includes creating a roadmap that starts with amending the December 2015 deal setting up the interim government of national accord. Another world leader in New York this week is Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani, who Tuesday called on Pakistan to work with Kabul to curb extremism. Speaking to the General Assembly, Mr. Ghani said he welcomes the U.S. announcement of another 3,000 U.S. troops. Wednesday, the Afghan leader said he believes President Trump's strategy to win the war will work with its regional approach to security. Mr. Trump hosted African leaders in New York Wednesday, announcing he's sending his U.N. envoy Nikki Haley to South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo in search of peace.
We're closely monitoring and deeply disturbed by the ongoing violence in South Sudan and in the Congo.
The president said Haley would discuss avenues of conflict and resolution and, most importantly, prevention. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 12 people are known dead, nearly 20 injured, and dozens more are missing after heavy rains caused flooding in two eastern villages. Dozens of homes have been destroyed in the area some 60 kilometers northwest of Goma. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, September the 21st, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. A 10-year-old boy was killed and many others were injured in Togo's capital Wednesday as hundreds of thousands of opposition supporters demonstrated against a vote by the parliament on a bill they feared will allow the president for more terms in office. And the Committee to Protect Journalists says that Cameroon has been using its 2014 anti-terror law to silence critics and suppress dissent.
You don't have a right to demand information and get it. A government that really wants a free press does that as one of the first things, because it's then that you begin to hold journalists accountable for the quality of information they put out, because they have every means to collect information correctly.
That's Cameroon's Standard Tribune editor-in-chief Eugene Fongwa. And in Gambia, a commission of inquiry to look into the financial activities of the former dictator Yahya Jammeh and his government found that millions of the Gambian currency, the dalasis, were withdrawn from the central bank without proper documentation. And various African leaders are in New York this week for the UN General Assembly, including Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, whose large delegation of more than 70, that includes his wife, children and grandchildren, has been a subject of much talk among Zimbabweans worried about the cost of the trip at a time when the country's economy is struggling.
This shopping thing, they do it at the expense of poor Zimbabwe.
Fortune Lalazi of the opposition People's Democratic Party, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti. Those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A 10-year-old boy was killed and many others were injured in Togo's capital Wednesday as hundreds of thousands of opposition supporters demonstrated against a vote by the West African Nations Parliament on a bill that they feared would allow the president to run for more terms. Togo's Security Minister Damehame Yark blamed opposition members for the violence, saying that they brought weapons to the demonstrations. Thousands of people across the small West African nation have been demonstrating since last month, asking for term limits on President Faure Gnassingbé, who has been in power since his father died in 2005. The Gnassingbé family has ruled the nation for 50 years. Security forces killed at least two people and injured several others in demonstrations in August. They used tear gas to break up another peaceful protest this month. The ruling party voted Tuesday in favor of a draft bill that the opposition said did not include a sentence outlining term limits for the president. And today is the International Day of Peace, the day which is devoted to strengthen the ideals of peace within and among all nations and people all over the world. Reporter Moses Havyarimana revisits Bujumbura's neighborhood, the hotspot of the 2015 violent protests, 2 years after.
Here in Cibitoke, a Bujumbura neighborhood where protest against President Pierre Nkurunziza took place was considered as one of the most insecure places to be in 2015. Business here have started picking up, as most of the traders here had by then fled due to the violence that claimed more than 500 people. I met Billy, a 45-year-old carpenter. He explains how the situation is like now.
About work is not as it used to be, you know, but at least there are some changes in security-wise, because now, like this area, in 2015 you couldn't enter here, and people couldn't even go on street to do their businesses. But now at least it's fine. But poverty is the main challenge.
Traders in Bujumbura expressed mixed reaction concerning about peace. Regardless being able to do their businesses on streets here, some say that peace comes hand in hand with the financial stability. Ines owns a small grocery here in Cibitoke.
I couldn't work because of the chaos which was here, so I wasn't able to work, but now we thank God that we can at least sit here by the roadside and start working. Peace is something that we should promote because it is everything.
Burundi had enjoyed 10 years of stability since 2005 after the Arusha Agreement came into force in 2000. But the country is yet to find a sustainable peace. Justin Zoisaba is the chairman of the National Dialogue Commission.
So I think we are trying in every corner. Inter-Burundian Dialogue, which is led by MUCAPA, is programmed in October. We hope that this will finish with good result. Peace resides in the heart. A person doesn't have peace himself or herself, it is not easy to give to others peace. So we hope that it will end well.
In Burundi, peace had been advocated in different platforms, especially to disseminate information to the youth. Natasha is a prominent Burundian artist. She says that peace is everything.
Peace advocate, and I love my country, so I always sing about peace because Burundi needs peace and it is the foundation of development. I call on Burundians to come together and be one and put an end to anything that divides us.
The UNHCR and the Burundian government are set to repatriate more than 12,000 Burundian refugees back in the country by the end of this year. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. In the Gambia, a commission of inquiry established by the government of President Adama Barrow to look into the financial activities of the former dictator Yahya Jammeh and his government have found that millions of the Gambian currency, the dalasis, were withdrawn from the central bank without proper documentation. 22 bank accounts were traced to the exiled dictator Yahya Jammeh. Army officers and the state house staffers received money on behalf of Jammeh even after the expiration of his term as president. Three former governors were invited to the commission on Tuesday, Pat Nderimbai reports.
Three fired former governors of the Central Bank of the Gambia have appeared before the Jammeh Commission to give evidence on the 22 bank accounts operated by the former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh at the Central Bank. The accounts had to do with government projects in which Mr. Jammeh in some occasions was the sole signatory to the accounts. Monies were being withdrawn from the accounts without proper documentation from the recipients. Some of the recipients were close Jammeh confidants and security ADs. Mrs. Ami Bensuda is the lead counsel attached to the Jammeh Commission. Mrs. Bensuda confronted one of the former deputy governors about some of the withdrawals made at the central bank.
And then from Muri LBS Koli, who says he's been directed by His Excellency the President to receive 100,000 euro. Sanajaju, who said he was directed by His Excellency to receive $500,000. And again by Noha Williams, and this was the last transaction on the 3rd of January 2017 this year, which was authorized by yourself for $100,000.
Okay. Miss Umi Samba is a former second deputy governor at the Central Bank of the Gambia. She tells the commission that they couldn't defy the dictator's instructions for fear of possible reprisal.
These were trying times. We just couldn't say no to some of these requests, not even some of them. These requests we couldn't say no. Verbal. So what we tried to do was to document it. Verbal instructions. Nobody works on verbal instructions. Because a day like today would come. I've been in the bank long enough. I was there for the Agali Commission. We were the ones digging out the documents. So we knew exactly what would happen. We knew that a day like this would come.
Indeed, the day of reckoning has come, but lead counsel Ami Bensuda refused to buy Mrs. Samba's testimony. She said Samba ought to have asked for proper documentation before making the payments. Omi Samba again.
These were people with, I wouldn't say power, but they had authority. That's the sad part of it all. Sometimes I question myself, you know, sitting there with all this education, going through universities and everything, and then you're so helpless, you cannot say no.
Also testifying before the commission was Mr. Basiru Njai, the former first deputy governor at the Central Bank of the Gambia. Mr. Njai reminded the commission members that the Gambia was under dictatorship rule at the time.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that we were operating in a very abnormal, you know, environment. If you look at the records, it is absolutely, you know, clear that the president had, you know, direct control, you know, of the accounts. Solbagi and company would not have come to the Central Bank of the Gambia if they were not asked by the president, you know, to come and receive cash, you know, on his behalf.
The Janek Commission has been tasked to investigate financial dealings involving former dictator Jammeh and his government. The commission has been given 3 months deadline to complete its mission. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
The twin threats of climate change and unchecked development endanger indigenous cultures all over the world. To spotlight the challenges and some of the best homegrown solutions, the United Nations Nature for Development Program bestows so-called Equator Prizes. They are awarded to indigenous groups that create the most inspiring and sustainable grassroots development projects. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Jamison Irvin, who manages the Nature for Development Program and oversees its Equator Prize competition.
We're trying to change the way that people think about development. A lot of development that occurs is very short-term thinking. If you cut down a forest to provide timber, in the long term, that's not development because it's not helping the people in the community who depend on forests for their medicines, for their livelihoods, for their fuel.
Yet there still is development to be had and also investment for other people so that they can get a little bit of money out of it while furthering the sort of life goals of these villages and such, right?
Yes, but we have to remember the precept of the Sustainable Development Goals, which is that we will leave no one behind. And this idea of inclusiveness means that you start from the bottom first. You ensure that they have the tools that they need and the nature that they need to achieve their own livelihoods, food needs, and water needs.
Now, I understand you have this Equator Prize, which is part of your Equator Initiative. Can you tell me sort of in a nutshell what that is and maybe some of the people that you've honored this year?
The Equator Prize is a prize established to recognize outstanding local and indigenous communities in their efforts to manage nature sustainably in order to achieve their own goals. We recognized 15 of these communities this year to showcase our 15th anniversary, but they are representative of hundreds and thousands of communities that are taking action on managing nature sustainably for a truly just and inclusive sustainable development.
Give me a sense of the range of the Equator Prize winners this year. I know you've got 2 winners from Kenya and 1 from a very remote region of Mali.
Yes, it's an area that's rife with conflict, of extreme poverty, but they've enabled their youth to establish eco-guards, and they protect the Malian elephant population, which is one of the most endangered in the African continent.
That was Jamison Irvin, manager of the Nature Development Program at the United Nations Development Program. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips this week in connection with the convening of the UN General Assembly in New York. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is among several world leaders gathered in New York for the 72nd session of the United Nations General Assembly. However, prior to his departure, President Mugabe, who will address the General Assembly, sparked a whirlwind of discussion among Zimbabweans because of his large delegation of more than 70 that includes his wife, children, and grandchildren. VOA Zimbabwe's Gibbs Dube reports.
Critics argue that the delegation, reportedly receiving daily stipends of $1,500 each, is irresponsible at a time when the country's economy is struggling due to lack of investment and massive unemployment. Making reference to various images showing President Robert Mugabe slipping through discussions, Fortune Mlalazi of the opposition People's Democratic Party, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti, said there was no purpose for the Zimbabwean leader being there.
There is only one thing that the president is there to do, that is to slip
or we can substitute it with insulting others. That is the best that the president can do there in New York. He has got no meaningful contribution to the country or to the world.
However, Joseph Juma, a legislator and member of the ruling ZANU-PF party, dismissed the criticism, saying that President Robert Mugabe is right to attend the meetings as he plays a crucial role at forums such as the United Nations General Assembly.
There are a lot of agreements that take place there. There are so many conventions that have come out of those forums, and for the president to be part of that is very essential. I believe, if you remember, back then, there was the issue of the Security Council that the president and some other African leaders stood for until Africa was also recognized. So it is correct for the president to go to those kind of forums so that we advance our cause as Africa and as Zimbabwe in particular. But as Africa, really, we need to engage those people, and they need to see the collective voice of Africa standing up to say, we are equal as well to you, the first world country.
Chuma noted that critics of President Mugabe have no real basis to question the president's trips.
Such is right. Even Jesus was criticized. They called him a glutton and a drunkard, yet he was the Messiah. So we don't expect anything less as well. If you are the president, you are in the center of the storm. So those kind of criticisms are bound to come your way.
But Mlalazi said there is no proof of any outcome of the agreements signed or benefits to Zimbabwe.
There are no agreements. No one wants to sign an agreement with Mugabe. Or rather, they must show us some of those agreements and their success. We have seen people coming here promising to come back with investment, but they all disappear.
Further sparking debate about President Mugabe's trip to New York with his family was a picture that went viral Tuesday of son Palamine Chatunga at a McDonald's outlet and his security aides carrying shopping bags from high-end stores like Gucci. Mlalazi said this is the trend that the first family has been showing for some time.
It doesn't surprise us. You must remember that this whole thing started with the father, then came the mother. Now it is with the children. It's going to also cascade down to the grandchildren, this shopping thing. They do it at the expense of poor Zimbabweans.
But Chuma raised issue with this argument, saying all young kids like high-end merchandise. Chuma said, contrary to belief that the government is paying for the family's expenses, the first family has enough of its resources to foot the bill.
Let's be honest here and sincere. I would wish for my child whatever the best value, I mean, in life, and so would you, so would anybody else. And so if the president's son decides to get something good for himself, and especially also consider that he is not taking money from the fiscals, he is not taking money from government, because we must remember that this very first family that we are talking about is an entrepreneurial family. We know they are running businesses here in Zimbabwe.
Mlalazi questioned the productivity levels at Alpha and Omega company that the family owns, saying many in Zimbabwe cannot afford the company's products.
We know is that that farm, Kushungo Dairies, produces poison, and no one buys that poison. In simpler terms, they are producing ice cream and all those other small things. Zimbabweans cannot afford to buy ice cream. So where are they getting that money from? They cannot sell ice cream and buy Gucci. It doesn't make sense.
President Mugabe, who is contesting in the 2018 presidential election, will address the United Nations General Assembly on Thursday. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, this is Gibbs Dube in Washington.
This is Daybreak on the Voice of America. And for our final story, Cameroon has been using its 2014 anti-terror law to silence critics and suppress dissent. That's according to a report released by the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaounde.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says Cameroon's government is using a 2014 anti-terrorism law to arrest and threaten media who report on the Boko Haram insurgency or controversial topics like the ongoing strike in English-speaking zones. Bruno Kwemu of the Cameroon Union of Journalists says reporters fear practicing their profession. He says Cameroonian journalists are not criminals. He says his union recommends the strict respect of ethics and professional norms. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 5 journalists in Cameroon have been arrested and charged under the law, which introduced hefty punishments, including the death penalty for involvement or complicity with terrorism. RFI Hausa reporter Ahmed Abba was sentenced to 10 years in prison earlier this year. He was arrested in northern Cameroon, covering the war against Boko Haram. Rights groups say he was tortured during his 2-year pre-trial detention. His lawyers are appealing his sentence. 4 other reporters arrested under the 2014 law were recently released. They had been detained in relation to their coverage of the government's response to the Anglophone strike. By VOA's count, at least 30 local media outlets have been sealed or suspended over coverage of the unrest since the strike began in December. The government also cut internet access to the 2 English-speaking regions for 3 months as talk of secession began eclipsing the original strikers' demands. The government has repeatedly defended its actions in response to the strike, saying national security trumps freedom of expression. The Committee to Protect Journalists is urging Cameroon to revise the anti-terror law in line with international standards, decriminalize defamation, and abolish the National Communication Council with an independent regulatory body with narrower powers. The NCC is the state agency responsible for policing the media. VOA spoke to the NCC President Peter Isoka.
There may be an outcry, but these are just people who think that they have a certain aura around them and that nobody can touch them. Listen, it would be erroneous to tell us here that we have a heavy hand on everyone. There is not a single case that we have taken a decision on in which the people concerned are not summoned to the council and probably defend themselves.
Most of the journalists VOA contacted to comment of the Committee to Protect Journalists report declined, stating that they wanted to play safe. Standard Tribune editor-in-chief Eugene Fongwa says journalists in Cameroon find it difficult to do their jobs because the government is not open with information.
You don't have a right to demand information and get it. A government that really wants a free press does that as one of the first things, because it's then that you begin to hold journalists accountable for the quality of information they put out, because they have every means to collect information correctly.
Retired journalist Kome Emmanuel says the intimidation of journalists has scared the public from expressing views in the media, especially during call-in programs.
Under normal circumstances, under normal situation, we'll have more people expressing their points of view. That would have been the ideal, but the government has certain fears.
Asked for comments by VOA, Cameroon's Communication Minister Issa Chiruma described the Committee to Protect Journalists report as baseless. He said journalists in Cameroon are free and that the country will not succumb to external pressure to change laws. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that's it for this Thursday, September the 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a 3-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania, Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the road with Shaka on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.